Hey, this is Gary Parrish again from CBSSports.com. Again, it's Monday, February 9th, and this is the Eye on College Basketball podcast. I'm joined by Matt Norlander and Sam Vecini. Lots and lots of stuff to get to. We're going to get to it, but it would seem wrong on some level to start with anything other than the news of the weekend, specifically that former North Carolina coach Dean Smith died late Saturday at his home in Chapel Hill. He was 83 years old. He won 179 games, made 11 Final Fours, won two national titles. He was a member of the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame, the FIBA Hall of Fame, the North Carolina Sports Hall of Fame, the Kansas Sports Hall of Fame, and the College Basketball Hall of Fame. Coach Michael Jordan, Phil Ford, James Worthy. More recently, he had battled severe memory loss because of dementia and had not made a public appearance in several years. Didn't attend a ceremony in November 2013 where President Obama awarded him the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and now he's gone, leaving behind a massive legacy inside and outside of basketball. Matt Norlander, I want to start with you. Strictly in terms of basketball, what's Dean Smith's basketball legacy? What impact did he really have on the sport?
Pretty massive, actually. I did a post on the site. When he died, when I found out he died, I definitely thought about the fact that Dean Smith actually has connections to the very beginning of the sport of basketball and will kind of forever be linked to it, because he played under Fog Allen, you know, famous Kansas coach. And so Dean Smith is one person removed from Dr. James Naismith, who Allen, you know, was a pupil of, and Naismith, of course, invented the game. Okay, so that dates back to that part of the timeline. And then Dean Smith basically, for all intents and purposes, was the very first coach to recognize and implement in by ways of scouting and game plans, in-game strategy, the notion that the number of possessions you use really dictates and shows how good your team is. So he is the father of tempo-free basketball from a coaching perspective, and that's a facet of the game that will never, ever go away. So to me, that's the really amazing thing about Dean Smith, is that his impact on the game, while it also has touched so many just ridiculous figures. I did a post on that. I mean, the people that he either coached with, coached, played for, or really, you know, had coaching rivalries with is purely outstanding. And like, even like small things that are, I think, not well known or forgotten. Like, he did win a gold medal,
yeah,
with the United States team in 76. And that was the Montreal games, and that was very much becoming a turbulent time, especially coming off of 72, the very famous Olympics where the American team has never picked up their silver medals after the controversial ending against the Soviets. So there's, in terms of basketball, Dean obviously is just a titan in that regard, and I was pretty happy to see a lot of people realize that. I you know, not that people weren't aware that Dean Smith was one of the greats of all time, but I think a lot of people were educated on the fact of just like, okay, no, seriously, in terms of hoops and off the court stuff, this is what Dean Smith did, and it's pretty much one of the most remarkable lives of impact of any college basketball coach ever.
I think that's true, and you touched on it. Like Sunday was a weird day because you first have, I don't know if shock's the right word, because anybody close to Coach Smith understood, you know, what he had been dealing with, and that the end was probably not too far away. But still, you don't necessarily from a distance know that the end's going to be Saturday night, that the end's going to be this weekend, and so the news is announced Sunday morning, and you know, for lack of a better word, you have this first like shock sets in, like, wow, you know, Dean Smith died, and so that's sad because he was such a respected and beloved figure. But the byproduct of it is that it you know, we really did spend a day, sports fans, and certainly a younger generation of sports fans, learning about Dean Smith. And if there's anything neat about, you know, a moment like that, it's that people become more educated on what this man actually stood for and accomplished, both on and off the court. And the off the court stuff is, to me, on some level, even more interesting. He fought for civil rights. He protested the Vietnam War, the proliferation of nuclear weapons, the death penalty. He integrated restaurants and a neighborhood and the North Carolina Athletic Department. He enrolled, of course, Charlie Scott, who was the first African-American scholarship player at North Carolina. There's a great story also about, I think it was in 1998, so it was right after he retired. He went to a clemency hearing for a death row inmate and told the governor at the time, a man named Jim Hunt, right to his face, like, "You're a murderer. The death penalty makes us all murderers." I mean, to have a basketball coach take these sorts of very public stands is fascinating and seems almost unimaginable in the year 2015. Like, Dean Smith had a massive impact in basketball. You detailed that. But his impact outside of basketball was maybe more important. He quite literally changed part of the segregated South and, you know, never stayed in his so-called lane and realized he could use his position of influence to help create a better place. And I'm curious, Sam, do you think there's any comparable coach in college athletics right now? Like, does anybody really speak out on social issues? I honestly, like, I was trying to think about it yesterday. I honestly can't think of anybody. I mean, I know, you know, people will raise money for, you know, Haiti after an earthquake. I get all that. But, like, are there any college coaches in any sport, any sport that where your voice actually matters, who stands up on controversial social issues or political issues and actually says something worthwhile? I can't think of any.
Yeah, I don't think there are either. I mean, you look at Smith's impact. Like, there was another story yesterday about how even like in 1958 when he was an assistant, he, you know, he like went and sat down in this restaurant with an African-American guy.
Right.
And he was just trying to get things desegregated then, even when he was an assistant that, you know, may or may not have been recognizable throughout the city of Chapel Hill, but he was recognizable enough to where he knew it would make an impact. And after that, he said, like, you should never be proud of doing what's right. You should do what's right. Just do it. And that's like one of the more incredible quotes that I could hear, like, that anyone could really even say in a situation like that, in my opinion. And yeah, there's not really anyone that even like comes close, in my opinion. Now, yeah. Everyone's very, very, very by the book. Very, you're not going to get guys that are going to really stand up for social issues. Like, often, like, a lot of guys accept them.
Right.
Like, I think we saw that with the Michael Sam thing in the NFL last year and in college sports at the end of his career. But, you know, like, I don't think that beyond acceptance, we're really getting a lot of people that stand up and make an effort and really stand up and really get their opinions out there and really try and make an impact.
No, I mean, I'm trying to think of the issues that could present opportunities to do that if you wanted to. So
there's only one as of late. We actually talked about it on the podcast in the preseason, and that's when Krzyzewski spoke out against Obama and him not putting boots on the ground in the Middle East. Remember that?
Yeah.
Whole deal?
Obama bashing?
Right, exactly. It's a different thing, but it's the only thing remotely even close that I can think of.
And we've had some really, you know, Trayvon Martin, we've had Ferguson, and those are opportunities for, if you felt a certain way, and just trust me, there has to be college coaches who felt a certain way, if only because there's millions of Americans who felt a certain way, and yet nobody, to my knowledge, like, stood up and really said anything important. The last one I can actually remember, you remember Pat Kelsey after Sandy Hook?
Yeah.
Okay, so I remember him, like, using his press conference. It was after they had played, I want to say Ohio State, but it could have been anybody.
I think that's actually right.
Okay, yeah, but it was a power conference school, and it was right after, you know, another school shooting and just a gut-wrenching scene. These babies being slaughtered, and you know, Pat Kelsey, you know, he actually said, I don't know how often I'll be in front of a microphone in front of this many people, but we have to do something, you know, as a country, we have to do something. And I was fascinated by that. That he felt, first up, not fascinated that he felt that way. Jesus Christ, how could you not feel that way? But that he actually decided, I'm going to try to use whatever voice I have to make a point. And if I've got to go back to Sandy Hook and Pat Kelsey to think of a college coach, like really saying something, trying to say something important about a controversial or big issue, like that's kind of pathetic, isn't it?
I want to, you know, the Georgetown players wore I Can't Breathe shirts. I think John Thompson III might have said, or maybe it was his dad, I can't remember which one. If it was his dad, it was no shock, because actually John Thompson is pretty much right up there with Dean Smith in terms of societal and cultural issues and just not giving a damn about, you know, what people think of his opinion and speaking out. But after that, I think he said something to the effect of, you know, this is college. It's more than just playing sports. It's about expanding and growing your mind. And the thing that Sam mentioned that to me is really remarkable about Dean is the fact that it was the late 50s. Obviously, none of us were alive. We can't even fully comprehend what it was like to be in America at that point. And of course, we'll never really fully understand being a black person in America, period, but at that point. And for Dean Smith, who was pretty much a no-name, I mean, Sam, I'd go as far as to say that, you know, at that time, Carolina basketball, I'm sure it had some, you know, small local pride, but it wasn't anything. I mean, Dean made the program. So he was just, you know, a local assistant basketball coach at the college. And here he was, late 50s, you know, the civil rights movement had not truly hit steam at that point. To me, that's the most remarkable thing. And the other thing that surprised me, just to kind of twist the Dean Smith thing, is when he died, I went and looked up the all times wins leaders, because I thought, well, Wooden died. And I was like, is Dean Smith really the only other like big time coach that's basically died since the mid 90s? We've got, first of all, John Wooden is 55th on the all time list of men's winners, which is beyond shocking. I would have thought he would have been top 30.
He didn't coach long.
Exactly. He didn't coach long. He people forget that he kind of retired early out of nowhere, and seasons were so much shorter.
Right.
But that's what I'm getting
thing. Like
at
when
is,
I was a kid, coaches would brag about 20 win seasons. Like, the 20 win season, I can remember, I don't even know if this was ever true, but just as a kid watching college basketball, it was like, if you get to 20 wins, you're going to be in the NCAA tournament. Like, that was sort of an accepted thing. And now if you win 20 games, it means you lost 16 probably, you know?
Well, yeah, and that's actually one of Dean Smith's greatest accomplishments that right now a lot of people might not emphasize enough, but for 27 straight years, he won 20 or more games in a time when you were basically playing 25 to 28 games a season. So that's just flat out remarkable.
Great.
To the greater point, I'm happy the fact that we still have so many coaching legends still alive. I mean, I don't want to get too macabre here, but I guess Tarkanian's probably going to be the next one because he also
is. Oh, wow. Predicting deaths on the podcast.
We're not going to be opening up death pools or anything like that.
Sam, you got. So Tark's off the board, Sam. Who you got next?
I don't know. Who's on the list, Matt?
Listen, it's good that. Listen, like, you know, Krzyzewski, Boeheim, Knight, Calhoun, Sutton, Lefty Driesell, Lute Olson, Lute Henson. I mean, you know, Huggins, all these guys, Norm Stewart. These guys are still kind of kicking, John Chaney. So we still have so many living legends in the game, and I guess I wasn't really fully aware of that until Dean died. And it kind of made me think, you know, I don't know if that's really true of really any other sport. I mean, obviously, like, you know, Henry Iba, Adolph Rupp, Fog Allen, kind of those big ones have passed on. But there are a lot of guys near the top of the wins list that are still going, and that's a great thing.
All right, let's talk some basketball, actual basketball. On the court, the big story of the weekend, Virginia beat Louisville but lost Justin Anderson. Hand injury, surgery yesterday, going to be out 4 to 6 weeks. That's the official timeline. Probably not back, if that is accurate, at least until the ACC tournament. Norlander, Virginia still get a one seed without him?
Oh, no. Probably not. Listen, now is the time for Malcolm Brogdon to live up to that preseason Sam Vecenie hype. Virginia will still be okay. I think they'll be okay overall. That's actually the way Tony Bennett kind of schemes his guys. They're almost built to be able to take on a loss like this. But I still think that they're probably going to end up with a two. Without having him hitting a major stretch in conference play, every coach knows that, you know, the back half of February is usually the toughest because guys are anxious to get to March, but you're still playing really good quality opponents in conference that know you, and you don't want them to get into this rut where they might, you know, just not take opponents as seriously enough as they should, and then you get picked off and lose a game or two that you shouldn't. I'm not necessarily saying the Cavs are going to hit a three-game losing skid, but I do think they're going to lose one or maybe two games they otherwise wouldn't have without Justin Anderson, who's been, you know, a top 10 player, you could say maybe even top 5-ish yep. player this year,
sure.
considering what he's done.
Yeah, I mean, okay, like I looked at the schedules, Sam.
Yeah,
they've got,
that's what I think.
Yeah, there's not much there. I mean, they got one more road game against a likely NCAA tournament team.
I don't even know if that's true about NC State anymore. Like, they got
to go to Louisville.
14-10. Oh, yeah. On March 7th, though, and yeah. I think there's a chance he'll be back by then.
Well, I mean, so, according to their timeline, if it's literally 4 weeks at the earliest, then
yeah.
that's March 8th. So, but certainly, we've seen people come back early. He could be back March 7th, even if it, you know, it could, whatever. Like, they might right. only have one road game left yeah. against a likely NCAA tournament team.
I'm saying they're not going to get a one seed because I think he'll actually miss the ACC. If it's 4 to 6 weeks, I'm just saying I don't think they'll win the ACC tournament, and that will prevent them from getting the one.
Here's the thing, though. If they go, even if they lose two of these games, they go 27-3.
Right.
Are you going to hold them out with that? Like, with
that's
that
my thing. Their resume is so strong right now.
Yeah. Like, they're going to win the ACC outright.
Yep.
They're going to have that non-conference schedule at 27-3, even if you lose to NC State this week and lose at Louisville, because they have Wake Forest, Pitt, Florida State, Wake Forest, Virginia Tech, Syracuse. Like, that's right. an easy, easy stretch that probably lends itself to going, you lose, I think they're probably only going to lose one of those games, but even say they lose two, that's still 27-3, that's still 15-3 in conference, that's still an incredible non-conference slate, and you say 28-4, they win a game and lose a game in the ACC tournament.
That's still a top four resume.
That's still absolutely a top four resume. I don't see any way that they don't get a one unless they really like go into the tank
right.
offensively. But I don't think that's going to happen either. Anderson's yeah. really, really good. He really like his gravitational pull of the defense with the way that he can stretch the floor and space the floor for the rest of their guys is really, really important. But they, like Matt said, they're kind of built to take on something like this. I'd expect guys like Marielle Shayok and Evan Nolte to be able to step up a little bit, and then the rest of the guys in the starting lineup be able to step up a little bit. I think they're not fine, but they're going to be able to get through this easier stretch of their schedule.
All right, let's relatively unscathed. Let's just quick hit on who's going to be fighting for this then. Kentucky, like an automatic for sure.
Yeah.
Gonzaga is definitely on track. Wisconsin, that's three. Nova is still in the picture. Duke is still in the picture. And, I mean, do you want to say Kansas is in the picture? Arizona?
Yeah. Kansas is going to be in the picture because they're probably going to be Big 12 champs and their RPI is going to be ridiculous.
RPI is going to be ridiculous. They're at four losses right now. But Temple's their worst loss. They're probably Temple can make the tournament. Arizona took on a bad loss.
Has three sub-75 RPI losses. Yeah, nobody in the top 10 has more than one.
Yeah, Arizona's going to have to run the table and get help. So I would actually, wow, I mean, I can't believe it, but I think we kind of have to, unless they run the table. And now they're not going to do that because they're going to lose at Utah. I would think they're going to lose at Utah. They're going to lose at least one more game. So Arizona's out. Yeah, I'm kind of.
I'll tell you the one seeds. It's Kentucky. It'll be Kentucky, Virginia, Gonzaga, Wisconsin.
That's probably going to be it. By the way, I'm sure Mark Few's more than fine with it, but it almost feels like we're just not really giving 24-1 Gonzaga, who lost in overtime and probably should not have lost at Arizona, enough credit. And this is really turning into a heck of a season for that team.
I mean, they are ranked second in the country, even though I don't think they should be ranked second in the country. I think Virginia should be two and they should be three. But they're tremendous. Like every time I'm doing some radio show somewhere now, you know, Gonzaga comes up and they go, well, you know, are they really? Yes, this team's good. They're good enough. They're good enough to do the whole thing. I don't know that they will. Because I don't, you know, it's a single elimination tournament. Who knows? But they are good enough, I think, to not only make the Final Four, they're good enough to do the whole thing. So we'll see. Hey, you mentioned Kentucky. For the first time this season now, KenPom's math suggests that UK's more likely than not to enter the SEC tournament with a perfect record. This is the result of Saturday night's win at Florida. Gators played well, but Billy Donovan actually went in on his team afterward, basically said this is the first time he's felt like his team has really played all season. First time they've actually played to win. Sam, we've talked about this before, but I'm curious. I know you watched the game. Florida's now 500 in the SEC. It's the first time they've been 500 in the league this late in the season since 2008. Do you have a theory for why they have struggled other than the obvious, which is the players aren't good enough? This is wild to me. So if you go back and look at the class of 2013 rankings, composite rankings, 247 Sports, the top nine players in the country in that class, seven of them are already in the NBA. They were one-and-done products, seven of them. The other two are Casey Hill and Chris Walker.
Where were the Harrison twins on that?
Were they
like 10 and 11?
Yeah, like right after that. I want to say 10's Dakari Johnson. Oh, no. Yeah, 10's Dakari. I can look it up real quick. I think 10's Dakari Johnson, actually. And I guess the Harrisons were after that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, regardless, though, I think that's it. You have Casey Hill and Chris Walker, who aren't giving you anything. And then their recruiting class this year, Devin Robinson's been okay. They just lost a lot. Like, they lost five legitimately huge pieces off of a Final Four team in Casey Prather, Scotty Wilbekin, Patrick Young, Will Yeget, and then, maybe it was only four, but, like, still, they lost. An insane amount from that team. They lost basically all of their, I don't know about all of their scoring, but they lost probably 90% of their scoring. Like, it's really, really, really hard to come up with that and really, really fix that in a single season.
Right. Let me interrupt you real quick. Okay, so I had it wrong. Okay, it's one was Wiggins, NBA. Two was Randall, NBA. Three was Gordon, NBA. Four was Jabari, NBA. Then it's Harrison and Harrison. So five and six are starters for the number one team in the country. Then there's Walker and Hill at 7 and 8. 9's James Young. 10, Dakari Johnson. 11, Noah Vonleh. 12, Jarrell Martin. 13, Wayne Selden. 14, Joel Embiid. 15, Rondé Hollis-Jefferson. So basically, the top 15 guys, they've all been awesome or at least highly relevant college basketball players, except for the two who happened to enroll at Florida. And if when you're counting on two top 10 kids as sophomores and they're not great or even good, they're not even good, especially Walker.
That's a very reasonable thing to count on. Like, you would expect those two to be very, very good at this point. And I don't know, like, what's going on. I don't know what people saw in Chris Walker at this point. Like, I saw the same thing. He was an incredible athlete. He looked great in the McDonald's All-American game. He looked good, like, in any sort of high school tape that I saw him in. But here's the thing. He played in a really, really, really small classification of high school basketball. So we didn't really know what to expect of him. And it doesn't look like he's improved at all since that date. I mean, he looks totally lost when he's on the floor.
He looks lost. Yeah. And it's almost like how Kelly Oubre, like, remember how early in the year, you know, Oubre looked like a guy who had just got by his whole life on size and athleticism. And he looked lost on the court. Like, I was in Orlando with Kansas. He looked lost on the court, but he figured it out. Chris Walker is, you know, now a full year into it.
Year and a half.
Yeah. He hasn't figured it out at all. And I had Sean Farnham on the podcast several weeks ago. He does the SEC games for ESPN now. And so we were talking about Chris Walker, and he said he had an interesting conversation with Billy Donovan in the preseason about Walker. And Billy told Sean that he had set Chris Walker down, you know, after preseason workouts, but well before the games, and just said, okay, like, you need to understand what's about to happen, because people are going to people are going to recognize you're not as good as they think. You know, I'm looking at the mock drafts. I'm looking at, you know, a top 100 list of college basketball players, and you're all over these things. And how are you going to be able to deal with it when the whole country realizes you're not as good as they think you are? And that, I thought that was an interesting point that Billy made. He was almost preparing him for a disappointing season because he saw this coming. And what you would hope is that A, that conversation would motivate and motivate somebody in a remarkable way, or that this type of season, you know, would motivate him in a remarkable way, because he has he's fallen off everywhere. Like I don't think he's draftable right now. And this is a guy, and it's just on some level it's sad. I mean, because this is a kid who, if you know anything about his background, it ain't like my background, and it ain't like yours, and it ain't like Norlander's. I mean, he has on some level been counted on for years to be the, you know, the payday for a lot of people, and it doesn't look like it's going to happen right now. And that must be an immense amount of pressure for a 20-year-old. The idea that people have been telling you you're going to be a multimillionaire forever, and now it ain't happening. Like if the light goes on at some point, great. But right now, that seems like a world away.
Yeah. Like, here's the thing. I will absolutely be rooting for Chris Walker for like ever, just because of the way he was brought up.
Sure.
And he had a really, really difficult run of it from the time he was really, really young until the time he was like 18 or 17. And now he's just not very good at basketball, and it sucks. And I don't know if it's like maybe he needs a change of scenery. Maybe he just needs to go to the D League or something, and he needs to have someone figure out what's going on with him. Someone different that isn't Billy Donovan,
I guess. Like,
I just don't know. I don't think that would be great for him.
Yeah.
But maybe it's just, maybe he's just one of those guys that isn't receptive to Billy Donovan. Maybe he could transfer somewhere else. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
It's just like, it's clear it's not coming on at Florida.
It's not working, but like run away from the guy who like had Joakim Noah and Al Horford and like,
oh no, it doesn't seem smart. Donovan's incredible.
Yeah. He like, who's been better with bigs in, you know, the past 10 years than Billy. And, you know, for whatever reason, this one just isn't happening. Like, I can see it at another program almost. Like, if you're a top 10 recruit, and by the way, at another program, like, the coach would be getting killed over this. You get to have two top 10 recruits as sophomores. Like, you don't even get them as sophomores typically. Like, you have a top 10 recruit, they ain't becoming sophomores. But you get them as sophomores, and they haven't developed at all. Like, if this were going on in different programs, like, Billy would be questioned, but you can't really question Billy about developing players because, my God, I mean, look at all the players he's developed and put into that league. But it's a weird and rare situation. It's a little bit like what I said about Oubre early. I wasn't commenting on whether Kelly Oubre should have been playing more in November or playing less in November, or if he was just that when you are rated where Kelly Oubre was rated coming out of high school, to spend the first, you know, 10 games of your freshman season buried on a bench is a pretty rare thing. It is a rare thing for a top 10 recruit to have that role early in his freshman year. Same thing here. I don't know what the deal is. I just know it is a rare thing to have top 10 recruits as sophomores be completely mediocre players.
Yeah, and here's the other thing with Walker, too. It doesn't seem like it's a thing where he wasted this offseason. Like, he got into considerably better shape this offseason. Like, he put on a lot of weight. He looks much stronger. He looks much bigger, just a lot more ready to, like, bang in the post and a lot more ready to be that guy that was ready. But the skill just isn't there. Like, part of it does look like he doesn't really understand where he needs to be on the court, and that's part of it. But, like, even laterally, athletically, like, the explosiveness in-game doesn't look like it's there, like, compared to what you would see in high school or what we saw in the McDonald's All-American game, what we saw in these All-Star games. Like, it just doesn't look there. Yeah. Like, it looks like it's evaporated. And as far as Casey Hill goes, I still have some, like, Hill hasn't been as bad as Walker to where...
No, not at all.
You think that he's like, he might be a lost cause at Florida. Like, Hill's been decent. Hill might be able to turn it on next year. And honestly, like, I might say that Casey Hill should be on our top 100 list next year.
Yeah, no, no, no. Yeah, let's be clear.
He hasn't been terrible by
any
means.
Yeah, no, let's be clear. Chris Walker has been terrible. Casey Hill has been fine, just not fine
not
relative
top 10
to
fine.
Not yeah, top right. 10 high school prospect fine. He hasn't been fine relative to where he was ranked coming out of high school. Norlander, what's Fran McCaffrey's problem?
Man, oh man.
Jesus
Christ. You know, we're recording this here on Monday morning, and as we're recording it, the Big Ten's having its weekly conference call, and a reporter had passed along that McCaffrey this morning had said, you know, okay, so Adam Woodbury has poked, you know, one of his players, McCaffrey's players, has poked an opponent's eye three times this season. I can't give him the benefit of the doubt, especially because he got Melo Trimble on Sunday, and when you watch the play, I mean, Trimble's got the ball below his waist. He hasn't yet driven to the hoop, and Woodbury just out of nowhere brings up his hand and gets him square in the eye. And so McCaffrey yesterday after the game was asked, you know, what's the deal here? You know, is the league going to review? And he had he called it basically an unintelligent question to be asking about Woodbury's eye pokes, I guess. And then this morning he's like, I don't understand why this is such a big deal. Well, dude, like, can we point out any other player that's ever poked an opponent in the eye three times over the course of maybe 3 weeks or so?
That's my thing. Like, I'm not here to tell you it's intentional or an accident. I don't know. Like, I can't get into to Adam Woodbury's head. But I can tell you this. I watch a lot of basketball. I don't see other people poking dudes in the eyes like this.
Yeah, it just doesn't happen. So, I don't know if it's some sort of subliminal kind of thing that Woodbury's doing this, but I brought up the transcript from your tweet, Gary, and the reporter basically was, what did you hear from the officials regarding the Adam, you know, touching the guy in the eye or whatever it was? And McCaffrey's like, they said it, they poked him in the eye. And he's like, well, it's a flagrant now, thought maybe they explained it. And McCaffrey goes, don't misconstrue it, that's an excellent crew, but on that one I don't know. And then the final question is, that's three times though, why does he keep asking? He goes, next question, ask an intelligent question. And the reporter asks, why is that not an intelligent question? He goes, because I said so.
Yeah.
Here's the thing.
But first off,
if you simply just answer the question with even a little bit of, I don't quite know, I'm going to talk to Adam, then we're not even talking about this on a podcast.
Right.
He might not even be asked it on the Monday morning Big Ten teleconference call, and people aren't, you know, tweeting along his quotes. It's becoming a bigger thing because McCaffrey seems to not want to address the fact that this is something of a pattern. And both, you know, Woodbury's got a rep. Now McCaffrey's got a rep attached to this because of it. And it's not a good look, specifically because McCaffrey is a coach that, yes, he is a quality coach, but he also has some behavior of his own in the past where he's been extremely volatile during games. And people will connect those two actions and start to look at him and his program as something that's a little bit dirty and certainly unlikable. So it's not a great approach from Fran.
Yeah, no, that's my thing. First off, it's a perfectly reasonable question. Hey, what is going on with dude poking people in the eyes? Particularly because it has become a bit of a regional, if not national, controversy in the small world of college basketball, at least.
Right.
So, like, it's a perfectly reasonable question to ask. It's a question that should be asked, frankly. And so you just handle it like a decent dude. You just say, nobody's going to convince me that Adam Woodbury's out there poking people in the eyes intentionally, right? I don't care what anybody says. That is not what he's doing. But clearly, like, it's happened three times now, and we got to look at it. I'm going to sit down and talk to him. We got to figure this thing out because I don't like talking about it, and I don't like to see it happening. It could cause a serious injury. So you want to paint Adam Woodbury as a bad guy, then you're a bad guy. But clearly we got to sit down and figure this out. Like, the people just applaud you if you say that. But when you try to be combative and dismissive of somebody who's asking a very reasonable question, then you look like, you know, you've choose the word. I don't think we're allowed to cuss on the podcast anymore, but you look like a cuss word. a lot of cuss words. It's just a bad look. I don't get the idea that you could be offended by somebody asking a question of why is your player poking people in the eyes on the regular. Like, that's crazy. That's you look stupid for calling that a stupid question. It's not a stupid question, but you just made yourself look stupid.
Without a doubt. You know what this is like? It's like Suarez. And is Iowa going to get to the NCAA tournament and Woodbury in like the first round going to poke something dude in the eye? Some dude,
Why don't we?
And then it's going to be like a big time deal with him. I mean, if that he can't do it again. Like if it happens again, pure accident or not, I mean, suspension is going to have to come. You can't keep doing it.
And I cannot stress this enough. Nobody else does it. So you've done it three times all on accident, which, again, it might just be all on accident. But you've done it three times on all on accident. And I can't think of anybody else who's done it at all.
Right.
I sat home this weekend and watched basketball basically from morning through night. I didn't see anybody else poke anybody in the eye. Adam Woodbury, I saw. And he's done it now three times. So maybe it is just something that he's doing, and it's leading to that accidentally. But it is something that he's doing. And for Fran to sit, you know, I just thought it was.
And what doesn't help Woodbury's case is that, you know, one of these three incidents were when, like, he kind of, like, caressed Frank Kaminsky's head, right?
Yeah.
And then he got him in the eye.
Right. Yeah. It's
really weird. Really, really weird.
Yeah.
And when it happened, Kaminsky was like, bruh.
Right.
Come on. Because that was the second time that it happened in that game. And that was about two, maybe 3 weeks ago tops that this happened. So
yeah. It's
just a weird pattern. And
if somebody wants to come out and say Adam Woodbury's the worst dude in the world, like that's taking it too far. I never met him. And I'm not sitting here trying to tell you who did it intentionally. All I'm saying is that if you're the head coach and this has already been a deal and it happens again on a Sunday on the Big Ten Network, then it is not a stupid question for somebody to ask you. And if you're the head coach of that team, you should answer it like a decent dude. You should sit there and acknowledge that I understand why you're asking that question. And I'm just going to stand – like the perfect thing to say, Adam Woodbury's not doing this on purpose. Anybody who suggests he is wrong. But this has become a deal. I'm watching it just like you are. We don't see people get poked in the eyes regularly, and yet for whatever reason, it's happened with him three times now, and we got to sit down and look at this. Like, I got to talk to him. We got to figure out why this is happening, and we're going to figure out why this is happening because it's painting him in a way that's unfavorable, and it could, in a worst case scenario, cause a serious injury. So, I don't know why it's happening, but. But I do know it is happening, and we're going to sit down and look at it just as soon as we get out of here or tomorrow. Like, no issue. Nobody has a problem if you say that. Nobody's clowning you. Now, you know, you're all over Twitter, Fran is. Deadspin's making posts about the Iowa coach, which is only – Deadspin's only going to make posts about the Iowa basketball coach if he, you know, kicks a chair or snaps at a reporter. It's just a bad look. I don't know why – Fran's a smart guy. I don't know why he's smart enough not to understand this.
Yeah. Yep. He's just oddly headstrong in this regard.
Oddly, oddly, oddly. All right, let's get out of here. We got some good games the next few nights. Oklahoma State is at Baylor. That's tonight. Then Kentucky at LSU on Tuesday. The Wildcats at any risk, Norlander, Sam? Any risk in Baton Rouge on Tuesday night?
This is the last
I think
one.
That Matt has a higher opinion of LSU than I do, so I'll let
him. I'm falling off it, though, man. LSU and Texas were the ones I think I was most wrong about. But this is the last – to me, this is the last one. If Kentucky gets by LSU, and I guess I'm leaning that they will. But LSU has a big front line. Like, this should be a challenge. I mean, if LSU was ever going to get up for the game of its life, it has to be this one, okay? This has been a very underperforming team. But if Kentucky does get by the Bayou Bengals – I'm not seeing how they get to the SEC tournament with a loss.
Yeah,
I think that they're going to get that regular season undefeated streak.
Sam, you don't think they're at risk?
I don't. I think that Kentucky basically does what LSU does, just better than LSU does.
Sure.
So, I think that's just going to be the problem, and LSU is going to be a little bit overmatched. Like, even Martin and Mickey are a little bit undersized for being, like, incredibly effective forwards like they are. So, I think that just the length of size is going to be a problem, and they don't shoot the three well enough, I don't think, to really stay in this game. But I do think that Georgia does, And there's a road game sitting there on March 3rd where Kentucky has to go to Georgia. And J.J. Frazier, Kenny Gaines, guys like that, they can get hot and maybe make that a game, I think. I wouldn't be surprised, at least, if that happened and that was the case.
The homie Hornsby can shoot it.
He's it.
Yeah. No,
I don't shoot like 31% from three or something this year, I think.
Yeah, no. Kentucky should win the game. I think Kentucky will win the game. I would say this though. Martin and Mickey are at the very least like Kentucky caliber players. You know, like they could theoretically be on that roster. And most teams in the SEC don't have players that could theoretically be on Kentucky's roster. Martin and Mickey could. So that's one thing. Secondly, and this would be the only thing that I would be worried about if I were Cal, is like you just played this high profile, you know, road game in a crazy environment and like had to really, really play, you know, for 38 minutes. And to then have to turn around and walk into something similar, you know, three nights later, that could, I think, be difficult. But still, you're looking for a prediction. Kentucky wins, and Kentucky does inner selection Sunday with a perfect record. Remember, you can subscribe to the Iron College Basketball Podcast on iTunes. Quickest way to get your hands on the latest edition. So make sure to do that, and I will talk to you again on Wednesday. Take care.